A black leather boot descends on the snake. It writhes, pinioned. Then the boot is lifted, and the snake bolts for cover. Orpheus opens his eyes and looks up at the owner of the boot.
Father?
Morpheus stands on the beach, looking down at the head.
Hello, Orpheus. You were unwise to seek favors of death.
Morpheus picks up Orpheus's head, holding it to the torn neck tenderly.
But you have made your own errors. It was your own life.
Morpheus carries his son's head towards an outcrop of rock.
I have come to say goodbye. It seemed the proper thing to do.
Morpheus puts the head down on a flat ledge. Orpheus looks up at his father helplessly.
I have visited certain priests on this island, in their dreams. They will find you soon and care for you. I will not see you again.
But father...
Father, did you not say you were no longer my son?
Please, father, help me. Help me to die.
Your life is your own, Orpheus. Your death, likewise. Always and forever, your own. Farewell. We shall not meet again.
Father? Father! Come back, please! Father?
Orpheus watches as his father walks away, unable to turn his head, even if he wanted to. The Lord of Dreams walks away slowly, pace by pace, through the sand and the foam. Orpheus watches through tear-stung eyes until he is out of sight. His father never even tries to look back.
The Sandman, Act 3, Episode 2. Fear of Falling.
It was getting late, and I was losing it, fast.
Todd Faber is a theater director in his early 30s. He lives in a fourth-floor walk-up apartment in New York. Todd's face is bleached and pale in the light of the TV. He looks preoccupied.
There was an old movie on TV, but I was too tired and too nervous to concentrate properly. It had Jimmy Stewart and some blonde woman, Kim Novak maybe, or Tippi Hedren, and a plot I just couldn't follow. Someone was dead, or maybe she wasn't, I don't know.
Some theater posters are pinned to the wall. A large suitcase is packed nearby.
I took a sip of coffee, but it had gone cold, and I was trying to decide whether to see if there was any left in the pot or to just forget it and go to bed. When somebody knocked at the door. Janet!
Hi, Todd. I saw your light was on, so I figured you wouldn't mind if I came by. You see, I was going over my part in my head, trying to figure out what it must have been like for Mary out on that island, when I sort of thought, oh, don't look at me like that, Todd. I know you're thinking, why doesn't she wait till rehearsal tomorrow? Well,
Janet, you might as well be the first to know I won't be at the rehearsal tomorrow.
You what?
I'm pulling out.
Typhoid Mary Blues is your play. You wrote it. Even the dumb songs in the third act. I mean, you're the director.
Look, bag packed, Todd Faber, go bye-bye, leave town. Not come back.
You're serious, aren't you? Why?
Watts Entertainment phoned this afternoon. The TV show? They wanted to know all about Todd Faber and Typhoid Mary Blues. And I told them I was out. And I put down the phone, and I realized my hands were shaking. And I'm leaving because I'm scared, okay?
But it's your play. We open next week. I mean, it's off-Broadway. But it's not as if it's off-off, or even off-off-off.
Janet, I don't want to talk now. I've written a letter that'll be read to everyone at the rehearsal tomorrow, telling them what I've done and why.
What is it you're afraid of? Failing or succeeding?
Good night, Janet.
Goodbye, Todd.
I gave up on the movie and went to bed. Eventually, I got to sleep. Eventually. Some dreams are different. Most dreams are a tangle of things. Foreground and background, subject and object. I once had a dream in which I was chasing a mad clown around St. Patrick's Cathedral, which was also my old high school. And after a while, I was the clown they were chasing. This dream was one of the different ones. It was in real time, and I was climbing up a rock face. I've never done any climbing in real life. Not even trees when I was a kid. I live on the first floor, which costs more and means there's no view to speak of, but I don't care. I don't like heights.
Don't look down. Don't look down. Don't look down. Don't look down. Don't look down.
Here I am in my dream, climbing like I was born to it. Hunting down handholds and footholds,
yes.
Wedging my
yes.
hands and feet into rock crevices, and slowly,
yes.
inch by inch, pushing myself up.
Yes. Yes. There we go. Yes.
And finally, I get to the top. And I start to realize how far up I am. And how far down everything else is. And then I realize that I'm not alone. There's a man standing on the top of the rocky spire, dressed all in black. His eyes are like blazing stars. His skin is white. His hair and his cloak are black. In the sky above him flaps a huge, ragged black bird.
Whew. It's a long way down.
Yes.
I can't believe I climbed all the way up here. I hate heights. I really do. I've hated them since I was a kid. You see, Hey, I don't want to bore you. Are you interested in dreams?
You might say that.
Well, that's good. Most people are bored to death by other people's dreams, you know? You see, for me, it all goes back to this one dream I had when I was 5 or 6. I couldn't have been any older.
I remember I was trapped in this house full of witches. I couldn't get out. And finally, I got to the top of the house, and I climbed out onto the roof, and suddenly, slowly, it tilted and threw me off. I could see the ground coming up below me, and I knew that if I hit the ground, I'd die. I knew that. It didn't matter if it was a dream or not, I'd still be killed. Just as hard as if it were real life. Worse, maybe. I remember the panic, the sheer gut fear as I tumbled down towards the ground, and I couldn't do anything to stop it. So I made it stop. I didn't wake myself up, but I pulled myself out of the dream. And I was just trapped inside a sleeping body. I didn't dare go back to the dream. I'd die. But I didn't know how to wake myself up. I tried to scream, hoping that maybe I could wake someone up who'd come and wake me up. I tried to thrash about. It was the longest, scariest time I have ever spent. Trapped in my head, in the dark. And eventually, somehow, I did manage to open my eyes. I was soaked in sweat, and I started crying. Partly because I hadn't died, and partly because I was alive. Ever since then, I've been a little scared of high places.
I see.
And then the raven spoke to me. And I thought, birds can't talk. And I thought maybe they can in dreams. And that was when I knew I was dreaming.
You're running away, aren't you?
I'm not running away. It's just I don't know. It's all getting to be a bit much for me. I feel I'm out of my depth. I'm scared. I'm scared I'm going to do something stupid.
And if you do something stupid, what then?
Aren't you scared of falling?
It is sometimes a mistake to climb. It is always a mistake never even to make the attempt.
What are you saying? That I ought to go back to the show? Not walk out? Is that what you're saying? You're just a dream. Listen, I've made up my mind.
If you do not climb, you will not fall. This is true. But is it that bad to fail? That hard to fall? Sometimes you wake, and sometimes, yes, you die. But there is a third alternative.
And that is? Huh? Where'd you go? No. No. Please, no.
When it's really happening, it's not like the Roadrunner cartoons. There's not going to be a me-sized hole in the desert floor. I'm just going to hit the hard rock from a great height, and that will be that. And I'm about to try to wake myself up when...
But there is a third alternative.
And I stayed with it. And I didn't wake up. And I didn't die.
Hi, everyone. Look, guys, there's something I have to tell you. It's about Todd.
What about Todd, Janet?
Yeah, Janet.
Todd!
What about Todd?
Can we
talk about it later? Okay now, everybody, can we take this from the scene in the basement? That's Act 2, Scene 4. I need God, Sappho, the Hanged Man, the Slave of the Lamp, and Typhoid Mary on stage. Everyone else, go over your lines or practice pretending not to read your notices.
You seem different today.
I met someone who changed my mind about a lot of things. Things to do. Art to create.
I'd like to meet her.
It's a he. And I don't even think he exists. He's just a little voice in the back of my head saying...
Yes?
Sometimes you wake up. Sometimes the fall kills you. And sometimes when you fall, you fly. Okay, everybody, let's take it from the top. Let's get this show on the road.
The Sandman, Act 3, Episode 3. Flowers of Romance.
For hundreds of years, or longer, the little goat-footed man had lived in the hills on the island. If you looked towards the rising sun, you might think you saw him silhouetted in the light of dawn. Of course, it could have been an outcrop of rock or a tree stump you were looking at, and the pipes he was playing could just be the wind as it blew across the island. But he was there, a creature of the moment, like all of his kind, and his memories were limited, although he could call up the scent and touch of 100 women and nymphs and dryads and naiads in his mind when he needed them. His own stink was goatish too. And he was small and crooked, with a wicked smile and hair tight curled, and the most becoming brown horns, which he oiled with olive oil and beeswax to prevent them cracking. In the spring, he rutted, and there never was a woman of any breed or kind could refuse the goatish stench of him. Or the grin, or the horns. But that had all been many springs ago. There were no longer dryad girls in the trees, their skins smooth as fig trees or flaking like plane trees. There were no longer naiads by the seashore, their flanks slimy and gentle as waving fronds of seaweed, their briny kisses tasting of the ocean.
Slippery.
And there were no longer human women in the hills to be drawn to him, whether they would or not, by the haunting tunes of his pipe. And after they had rutted,
aren't you pretty?
Happily to twine red flowers about his horns and in his hair. There were no lovers left for him. The last of the olive groves withered and died, and without oil, his horns became cracked and rough. And one day, the little goat-footed man looked into the water of a pool and saw snow in his hair and his beard and deep lines on the face that stared up at him. And the goat-footed man laughed and mocked the lying reflection and pissed a spray of rank goatish piss on its face, breaking and distorting it, for he told himself that he was a young thing still in the young ages of the world. But still, he remembered when the weather had always been warm. Now the island was cold and barren, and nothing lived, and nothing moved. And when the first flakes of snow began to fall on the island, the shivering goatfoot clambered to a high place, and it spoke to its heart, invoking a promise its kind had been given in exchange for a gift at a wedding in the dawn of the world. And its plea was answered.
There. And I thought you were gone too, sweetest of all my creatures. For other things, desire. But you and your kind were nothing but desire, wrapped in a thin shell of magic and flesh. But your time is done, and soon my sister will come for you, and then you will go to Dream's drear realm where all of your kind go to die, and the world will be the duller for having no set years in it. And you will not even last until spring, little thing.
And it looked up to Desire with want in its heart. And with brown eyes, and with all its soul, it asked Desire.
Please? Well, I suppose I could, if I wanted to.
And again, silently, the little goat-footed man asked.
Please? Very well. A little gift to you. To take into the dark.
The winter wind whips flakes of snow around the man and the woman dragging their boat up the beach. He is in his 40s, an archaeologist. She's about 10 years younger, a writer. The journey to the island looked promising when the winter sun shone on it. Now the dusting of snow from a grey sky makes it feel bleak.
Oh, I don't know why you took it into your head to visit this island of all places.
I don't know. Sudden burning curiosity. It's been abandoned even by monks and fishermen for 200 years. My guess is shifting fish populations killed the fishing trade and everything else collapsed from there.
Maybe it's nicer in summer.
According to the map, there's an abandoned village east of here. We can set up camp there.
I suppose this is what I get for dating an archaeologist. Well. Other girls get to go to Paris for Christmas. Did you hear something?
Don't know. What kind of something?
Music? I'm not sure. It might just have been the wind.
We're here now. Might as well have a look around.
It's getting dark. They find an old, abandoned shepherd's house. The door is unlocked.
We can set up camp in here.
Maybe. Strange odour, though. Wild goats, maybe? It smells like some animal's been here.
I think it smells nice.
Weird. Weird girl. Okay, I'm sure I can get used to the smell. Let's get a fire going in the hearth. That'll help.
It is music.
She walks across the snowy field in her thick pajamas. The wind has died down. The sky is clear, and the moon is full. Under a dead tree on the top of a rock, the little goat man is waiting for her, playing his pipes. He looks young again, and his beard is short and brown. The rock is twined with red flowers. She looks up at him and reaches up, and their hands touch. His bearded face moves in towards her red lips. The new day has come. Sue is by the rock, sheltered by the dead tree, lying upon dry, warm grass which shows no sign of the snow that has settled everywhere else.
Sue! Sue!
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Are you okay? What happened?
What? Oh.
I think you must have walked in your sleep. It's a miracle you didn't freeze to death.
Oh.
Here, wrap this around you.
I had the strangest dreams, Phil. Well, maybe I'll tell you one day. When I'm in the right mood.
You could have died from exposure.
Love kept me warm.
Well, that's very flattering. Maybe we ought to head back to the mainland. Don't know why I wanted to come here anyway. And look at this. Craziest thing I've ever seen. Red flowers.
All around where she has slept. On the warm patch of grass. The wild flowers are blooming.
It's like a little piece of spring.
As they walk away, back to the cottage, the dead tree upon the rock seems to shift with the movement of the winter sun. Could it be the silhouette of a little goatish man with hooves and horns? If it is, the satyr looks happy. He has had one final taste of desire. And as he plays, there are flowers twined in his hair again, between the polished horns. It is, of course, a miracle. As he walks along the beach in the grey-purple dawn, looking out over the Aegean Sea and then back at the island's coastline, Andros can never get over the honour daily done to him and to his family. Their privilege and their burden as custodians, guards and priests, as witnesses to the miracle. He is the oldest now, the head of the family, balding, with a grey-white moustache and a face dusted with white stubble. He's 70, but he looks younger. He wears rough canvas trousers, a shirt, and a cardigan. Each morning, at dawn, he clambers awkwardly up the concealed steps carved into the vertical cliff face, up to the headland. Each stone step curves deeply in the middle, grooves worn by his boots and by the boots of his ancestors. On each side of the steps is a sheer drop, with small, scrubby bushes growing out of the rock face. The steps are steep. At the top of the hill, he pauses to catch his breath. He's getting old.
Abudus Theos.
There are few signs of human settlement here. A scattering of fishermen's cottages on the beach below. A lone villa perched on the distant promontory across the bay. At the top of the cliff is the small white temple, set in a small garden. There are a couple of fruit trees and some bushes. It's just beginning to get light. Andros sees a movement from the corner of his eye, a boy with his hair in Bantu knots slipping behind one of the trees, hiding, but not very well. Andros has no time for that. He has duties to perform. The temple is a small, round building, like an observatory made of white marble, with a domed roof, four walls, each with an unglazed window, and marble pillars on either side of the arched entrance. Andros walks up the little path that leads to it, stopping at a cherry tree near a gravestone. Andros reaches up and picks a cherry blossom from the tree.
Giriamu.
There. Andros puts the cherry blossom down on the grave and walks on. Every spring day, for over 60 years, he has picked a blossom from the cherry tree. Every spring day, he has placed it on the lady's grave, as his father and his grandfather did before him. The gravestone is worn and old. It reads, Lady Johanna Constantine, born 1760, died 1859. Be to her virtues
very kind. Be to her faults a little blind.
Standing in the doorway of the little Grecian temple is a 40-year-old black man. He is tall and stubbly, his hair in corkscrew coils. He wears jeans and a t-shirt under a heavy cardigan. He holds a semi-automatic rifle, its stock on his hip.
Chris!
Hello, Papa.
Chris is Andros's son-in-law. 20 years ago, he came to the island, fleeing a war in a far land, driven by dark dreams. Andros's family took him in. They had been expecting him.
How was he tonight?
He slept for a few hours, then he wanted to look at the moon, then he was silent, now he sleeps once more.
Tell your half-wit of the sun that I saw him when I was coming up the path. Beat him for me.
He's too old for a beating, Andros.
That boy shouldn't be seen when he is on guard. Beat him. And as you do, tell him that when they stole our charge 200 years ago, it was 30 years before he returned to us. 30 years. It will never happen again.
He knows that, Papa.
If he truly knew that, then he would not have let himself be seen. Go down and eat, Chris. Go sleep. I will see you at dusk. Let's see how things stand today.
Good morning, Andros.
And to you, my lord.
Orpheus's head is still that of a young man in his late 20s. The head rests on a stone plinth. The eyes are open, and there is a gold ring in one earlobe.
Chris thought you were asleep.
No. Merely thinking.
Andros stands, looking down at the severed head. Beside it is an antique Greek vase, illustrated with a classical scene. There are flowers in it.
Did you put the flower on her grave?
Of course.
She was a remarkable woman.
All women are remarkable. Would you like me to move you?
Yes. Pick me up.
Where to today?
The east window, I think. I want to see the sunrise.
Andros carries the head to the window, facing east. Orpheus stares unblinking into the light. Then he begins to sing to himself, his voice little more than a whisper. He sings to the sunrise in a long-forgotten tongue. Andros listens to the song of Orpheus, and the ache in his joints eases. The cold leaves his fingertips. This is what makes him get up in the darkness, summer or winter, rain or snow. The song. In his soul, he feels young again. From the east window, one can look across the bay. There is a house on the hill across the bay, and occasionally Andros, whose eyes have lost none of their keenness in their 70 years on this earth, spies tiny figures there. Tourists, perhaps, or visitors to the island. He wonders what they see from their villa. A little temple on a cliff with a grove of olive trees and bushes and a fountain. That's all. Nothing special. The islands are littered with them, old shrines to gods long dead. The priests of Orpheus have had thousands of years to learn the art of misdirection. Even the most inquisitive tourist would find it almost physically impossible to find his way there. And if it came to more than that, well, the custodians have not been idle. Chris has drawn up plans that cover almost all eventualities, up to and including a helicopter assault on the temple. 30 years. It shall not happen again.
There. Enough. Please, Christos, carry me into the garden.
I'm Andros, Lord.
Did I say I'm sorry. I was thinking of your father.
No, thinks Andros Rhodokanakis. You were thinking of my grandfather. But he says nothing. It is going to be a beautiful day.
The Sandman, Act 3, Episode 4. Lives, Part 1.
Blossom for a lady. Rain in the doorway. Not her sister. Want, not want. The view from the backs of mirrors. Journal of the plague year. The number you have dialed.
A dingy street in central London. It's about midnight, and it's raining. The buildings look dark and grungy. The music comes from a small basement nightclub down the way, with a sign above its door saying, Orvendales. Most of the other doorways have people sleeping rough in them.
I've got any spare change, lovey. I need another 50p to put petrol on me Rolls Royce.
Yeah, hold on.
The old lady in the doorway is Mary Canby. She sits in a sort of nest she's made from a cardboard box, her legs covered by a blanket. She wears lots of layers of dirty clothes. She holds out a hand in a fingerless woolen glove.
Here you go. Not a nice night to be out.
Nah, at least it's warming up a bit, though. The winter was something cruel.
What about your friend?
What could be a pile of clothes beside Mary is, at second glance, a young girl, curled up in the shadows on the other side of the doorway.
Oh, she's asleep, I think. I mean, she was ill when I got here. Oh, it's a shame when it's the kids. I figure as old folks, well, we've had a good innings, but kids, I had a son once, dear. Oh, but he's no longer with us. Well, they said it was a industrial accident. But I know what was what. Oh, yes, I weren't born yesterday. It's not fair when the young ones die before the old ones. I mean, they're all we got to look forward to.
Yeah, well, good luck.
It'll take more than luck to help me, dearie-o. Ah, you've got a good heart. Hmm? There now, love. That was one of the nice ones. 30p and a bit of a natter. And I don't know, sometimes I think a kind word's better than the rhino. You should move up a bit there, love. You'll get positively soaked.
I've been wet before, I think.
Oh, you're awake. Feeling better?
Feel like, I don't know, someplace nobody ever goes anymore?
Delirium's pale face is wet and dirty on one side, where her cheek was leaning against the damp wall. She looks at the old lady with two mismatched eyes. One emerald green, the other pale blue, through which silver flecks swim like a shoal of tiny fish. Her hair is shaved close at the sides, but the multicolored mohawk she grew a while back has since grown out and drooped.
Spare change! Spare change! Spare change! Aren't you cold dressed like that? And look at you. How old are you, really? Run away from home, have you? You should go back to your mum and dad, love. I mean, they'll forgive and forget. Parents do. I would have forgiven my Stephen. Industrial accident. My Aunt Fanny.
I haven't got any parents. There was a big flood once, and I got really wet in that. Only it wasn't rain. It was the gunky stuff inside people's eyes. I wish I could remember what it's called.
You lost both parents? Poor dear.
I didn't lose my parents. I lost my brother.
What a shame. My Stephen died. They said it was a accident. But I've got papers. Oh, yes, I wasn't born yesterday.
One of Delirium's ears is pierced and studded all the way down. The other has a huge loop in it. She's slightly unfocused, but looks very serious.
So, lovey, how did your brother die?
He's not dead. I just lost him, okay?
Well, pardon me for breathing. Spare a little change, love. Little change, sir. Oh, thanks.
Change. That was always kind of the problem. Kind of.
Delirium steps out into the rain. She's barefoot, wearing a slightly ragged men's suit, much too big for her, with the sleeves rolled back to reveal her fishnet-covered arms. The trousers are belted with string.
Oh, some days I feel like Rita Marlowe in The Wayward Bus. You ever see the movie?
What?
Change. 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 When you say words a lot, they don't mean anything. Or maybe they don't mean anything anyway, and we just think they do.
Where are you going?
I need a change.
Clear off.
A big bouncer in a smart dinner jacket stands at the open doorway to the nightclub. He extends a huge hand, stopping Delirium from coming in. Next to him, Delirium looks very wet and very small.
Where do you think you're going?
Inside. It's raining out here. But not the jelly stuff in people's eyes.
Private party. Invitation only. We'll find a warehouse bash, eh, kid?
I've got an invitation. And I am dressed properly. Aren't I?
Yeah. Sorry. Go on in, love.
Aqueous something. Vitreous.
Pardon?
Oh, it's the name of what I can't remember. In people's eyes.
Downstairs, the nightclub is dark. Many of the clientele are dressed in rubber or leather, but this being the fashion side of the scene, there are young ladies in red or black latex and gentlemen in black leather pants, jackets, and caps. There are tables over on one side and a bar at the other with a crush of people buying drinks. In the middle, people are talking and dancing. Delirium comes down the stairs into the room.
If you need me, me and me will be hanging out with the Dream King.
When I told him the news about Freddy, he said, "Oh, another one bites the dust." I said, "Darling, when God put teeth in your mouth, he ruined a perfectly good asshole."
Delirium drifts through the crowd, her eyes wide.
To look like her. Looks like butter wouldn't melt between her legs.
Pushed through the gaps by the ebb and the flow of people.
I didn't lose him. I mean, it wasn't me. I wanted him to stay. I never thought he'd go. I asked him not to. It wasn't me, honestly. And I don't feel very well. I want my family back. I want my...
Delirium stops. In front of her, back turned, is someone familiar. A girl with a shaggy mane of black hair.
You?
The girl turns around. She is skinny and wears a skimpy black leather top with little silver studs on it. She has heavy, coal-lined eyes and wears a large ankh on a chain around her neck.
You came to see me. I'm sorry. I sort of got my head a bit tangled. Shall we go back to your place?
You're a bit ahead of yourself, aren't you? A bit too grubby for me, but I don't know. Buy me a drink and we can talk about it.
And Delirium should have known. Of course it's not death.
I'm Lisa. Who are you?
She's too tall for death. She's prettier, too.
I'm somebody else. The wrong person. I thought you were my sister.
Hey! Don't run away!
Delirium backs into a wall in which is set shards of mirror glass.
I want her. I want my sister. I want my sister. I want my sister!
She sinks to the floor near two people at a table. Donna wears a black corseted dress with shoulder-high gloves and high boots. The other person is Donna's boyfriend, Alan, dressed in a basque with even better makeup. He looks down at Delirium.
Are you all right, love?
Christ, where do they dig them up from?
Do you want some fresh air or some water?
Kids, no respect for the scene. Some people just blithely ruin it for everyone.
I think she's ill.
Eed out of her little bonks, I expect. Or whatever they're doing nowadays. Christ, it's pathetic.
Do you want me to get a doctor, love?
She's fine. I'll take care of her.
Oh, yeah? And who are you?
Well, sometimes I'm her sister.
Desire wears a white leather tuxedo with a white shirt and bow tie. Their eyebrows, lips, eyes and nose are perfect. Their hair is shortish and black.
Oh, honestly, girl, she's right. You are pathetic, making a scene like that. I could hear you screaming two continents away.
Desire?
Who else?
Excuse me. I've been watching you. You're gorgeous. So, what's your name?
No.
No.
It is a mistake trying to make out with Desire. There is only room in Desire's life for one person. And that person is Desire.
You see that young lady in red over there? Go and talk to her. Have a passionate weekend during which both of you make love until you're sore and bleeding. Then, without knowing why, refuse to see her again. She'll phone you up and hang around your house. When you ask her to leave you alone, she'll just cry and not say anything. Look at you with hurt eyes and follow you around. Eventually, this will make you so angry you'll find yourself needing desperately to make her say something. To make her react. To hurt her. To get her eyes out of your mind. After that, it will just be a matter of time.
Ah, okay. Thanks. Yeah, wow. Thanks a lot.
The woman moves across the room towards the person she has just fallen in love with.
Desire?
Yes, Delirium.
Will you take me away from here? Please?
Hold my hand. We'll go to my place.
The threshold is the fortress of Desire, a towering statue of Desire themselves, their arms outstretched, their face uplifted in a beatific smile. The chest is peeled back, as if for surgery, exposing the heart. Desire's home is in the heart. The walls and floor are flesh and fat and muscle, but there is also exotically upholstered furniture. Desire now wears a 1920s flapper dress and stands over Delirium, who crouches on all fours on the floor, looking as if she's about to throw up. The floor is writhing, throwing out tiny tentacles reacting to her agitated state.
I haven't seen you this bad in a while. Rotten night, huh?
I...
I'm finding it harder to hold on.
Hold on to what?
Everything. It all keeps moving and it won't stop, and I just want it to stop and it won't stop. Then I think, what if it gets worse? I mean, you know what? What if it gets worse?
Oh, come on, little sister. Pull yourself together.
Where delirium was, there is now a fluttering cloud of butterflies flying up from the vaguely human shape they occupied moments ago. The butterflies move in a cloud, heading off down one of the myriad passageways. Desire follows.
Delirium?
They enter Desire's gallery, a long room with framed artifacts on the wall, sigils of the other members of the Endless. Destiny's Book, Death's Ankh, Dream's Helm. An empty frame, a mirror, Despair's fishhook ring, and a splash of abstract colour for Delirium, who reappears below it as the butterfly swarm reconstitutes itself into human shape. Desire stands watching, stubbing their cigarette out into a heart-shaped ashtray. Delirium walks to the blank frame, Destruction's frame.
Delirium, come on, sis.
I'm together, aren't I? I know I used to be. I don't know.
Yes, you used to be.
Desire, I miss him so badly.
Indeed.
He was always kind to me.
And I'm not?
I didn't mean it like that. Desire, do you know where he is?
Not only do I not know, littlest sister, but I don't care.
Delirium walks to where Destiny's huge leather-bound book is chained to its frame.
Do you think it's in the big book? I mean, everything's in the big book. Maybe you'd show it to us, and then we could all be together again. One big happy family.
If our prodigal brother wanted us to find him, I'm sure he'd let us know.
Yes.
Look, Del, he's not here, okay? He's not one of the family anymore. Just accept it.
I want him back.
Drop it, Del. Just drop it. What's so funny?
You telling me to not want something. I mean, that's all you are, wanting. I mean, it's kind of funny. Isn't it? Isn't it funny? Well, isn't it? Desire, can I use your gallery?
What's wrong with your own gallery?
I lost it. It's somewhere in my own realm. I'm not sure where.
Sure.
Delirium moves to the frame that contains the fishhook ring.
Sister, I'm standing in my gallery. Only I'm not, because this is Desire's. But can I come see you? Please? Please? I'm holding your sigil, your ring thingy. Really, I am!
Obviously, she doesn't wish to be disturbed.
Please.
Delirium has, from time to time, visited Despair's grey realm. It is the antithesis of her own churning domain, formless and silent and still. Apathy hangs like a thick grey mist in the chill air, curling around her legs, clinging to the floor. No winds blow, no birds sing, nothing moves. She feels the cold touching her, sobering her. Cool tendrils move inside her, questing, whispering. Hanging in space, going off into the distance, are windows. Many of them are rectangular, but not all, by any means. Some are round, or arches, or ovals. Some are different shapes, some shattered fragments. Each window is, in our world, a mirror. So Despair's domain is full of the insides of mirrors, not like a picture gallery, but an endless, dark, bleak, misty plain. Some are horizontal, others vertical. They fade into the distance. Some of the windows let in light. Others let in darkness. Delirium sees the grey place that waits on the other side of every mirror, and she shivers. Ahead of her is despair. Despair is about 4 feet tall. She is naked. All the endless like dressing up. She likes wearing a body. The body is heavy. The head is too large, the teeth too sharp, a couple of lower incisors protruding up from her lower lip. Her hair is coarse, jet black, and tied in a rough topknot. On her finger is a ring with a fishhook sticking out of it, with which she absent-mindedly tears at her own flesh.
Hello.
Shush. Wait.
Despair stares into a foot-high window. It shows the family room of a dull Midwestern house. A man sits on a couch wearing a stained undershirt, smoking a stubby cigar. A nice, homely, bespectacled kind of guy, looking suicidally depressed, stunned.
So, who is he?
He manages a supermarket in a small town in Nebraska. Yesterday, his wife found a collection of pornographic photographs hidden in their garage.
The man puts down his cigar and picks up a drink.
Many of them involve children.
Oh.
She recognized her husband and their 5-year-old niece. She left him, taking the photographs with her. He fears she may have already given them to the police.
Despair turns to delirium. She is almost smiling.
Today, he's sitting in their sitting room, realizing that his life is over, wondering if he has the courage physically to end it. He doesn't. Isn't it beautiful?
It's okay, I suppose, if you're into that kind of thing. What's that?
Must be a rat somewhere down there. I can feel it on my foot. Here. Up you come, little rat. On my shoulder where I can see you.
Listen, I sort of have to talk to you?
Uh-huh. So talk.
It's about, our family.
What about it?
I always thought that maybe I ought to have a pet. I mean, you've got your rats, and our sister's got our goldfish, and I mean, even Stuffy Dream's got that big black bird, and Destiny's got the little flappy things. I don't know. What do you think?
What about our family?
Oh, yeah. I think maybe somebody should do something. That's all.
About what, Delirium?
Didn't I say?
No.
Oh, I thought maybe I did. Look, Despair, do you remember... do you remember...
Remember what?
The name of the gunky jelly stuff in people's eyes?
Vitreous humor.
Oh, yeah, I knew that. Thanks. Well, hang in there. I'll see you. Bye-bye.
Delirium. Is that all you wanted to know? The name of the jelly in people's eyes?
Not really. There's something else. You promise you won't be mad if I tell you?
I don't get mad.
Okay. Then you have to promise if I say something you don't like, you won't do that voice that sounds like people with wet and bubbly stuff in their lungs, buried under the ground, being crushed to death by giant worms talking.
I promise.
Our brother. I think we should get in touch with him.
Why?
He might be hurt. He might need us.
So?
I miss him.
So?
Will you help me find him?
Do you honestly think he wants to be found?
I don't know, but I want to find him. I just thought you could maybe help me.
If I say no, what will you do then?
Ask the rest of the family, I suppose. Desire said no already, so I thought, okay, I'd ask you next. It's just all been different since he went. It's sour and rotten, and I'm lonely. We never see each other. He made things okay.
Despair thinks for a moment, pulling at her lower lip with the fishhook ring. Blood dribbles down her chin.
No, I won't help you.
Oh. Well, thank you for not doing the voice anyway.
So, who will you ask now?
Dream, I suppose. He's the next oldest after...
He'll say no. You know that.
Are you sure you won't change your mind? I mean, Dream's much spookier than you are. And I'm always scared he's laughing at me behind his face.
I have my own responsibilities. And I respect our brother's privacy.
And you don't want to upset Desire, do you?
Despair pushes the fish hook into the flesh just below her left eye, ripping at it. The rat tries to climb the side of her face to get at the blood.
Oh, please, don't look at me like that. I'm going back to my own home. I'm going to think.
Where Delirium stood, three blind hummingbirds hang in the air like jewels of iridescent scarlet and cobalt. Then one by one they fade, all color leached from them, and fall lifeless into the mists to be eaten by the rats. Despair feels uncomfortable. In Despair's world, there are so many windows. Each opening shows her an existence that's fallen to her, some only for moments, others for many lifetimes. The little window mirrors hang in space, each with someone in it, the faces of despairing people. There are glimpses of a man shaving, a bride adjusting her veil, a view from above of a couple making love, and more. Walking past them, able at this moment neither to savor them nor to understand her own disquiet. She stares away from all the windows as she walks, her eyes staring down into the mist. Silent rats run unmindfully over her feet. She misses him. It is over 300 years since last